Today on Political Rewind, President Trump throws a monkey wrench into plans to name a successor to Johnny Isaacson's Senate seat. Georgia has seen a lot of the Democratic presidential candidates this week. How have they crafted their messages in the hopes of attracting Georgia supporters? Political Rewind starts now. I'm glad to have all of you with us for a Political Rewind. If you're watching us on our Sunday morning TV show or on Facebook Live right now, you can see that we're a very different studio. We are in the Radio Talk studio, just rebuilt here. Lots of wonderful graphics up on the wall. So if you're listening live on the radio, and it's a little bit after 2 on Friday afternoon, turn over to Facebook Live, the GPB news page, and take a look at what we're doing. We're pretty excited about it. It's been an extraordinary, an exceptional week in politics. Certainly people have been paying attention to the impeachment hearings coming out of Washington, but more especially for those of us in Georgia, people have paid an awful lot of attention to the comings and goings of Democratic presidential candidates who were here for the Wednesday night debate, did events before then and after then. We're going to talk about all that, plus an event that kind of shook things up just a few hours before the debate took place. And we'll tell you what that is in just a moment after I introduce today's panel. Jim Galloway is with us, of course. He's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He appears on the pages of the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays and oversees the Political Insider blog. We've had a busy week. You were working hard.
It's usually you see this kind of downward slope, slacking of energy as you approach Thanksgiving. This was an avalanche.
Yeah. It was crazy. We're all going to be thankful that it's over with by, you know, the end of the day today, and we can maybe take it a little easier next week. Melita Easters is sitting next to Jim Galloway. She, of course, is the founder and the director of the Georgia Win List, which identifies women candidates who are pro-choice to run for office. Melita, how many candidates do you have already involved in the 2020 election cycle?
We will be announcing the week after Thanksgiving a slate of 12 early endorsed candidates that I hope you'll have me back to talk about.
On various levels? Are these legislative candidates?
All legislative, Senate, and House seats.
All right. Yeah, we will have you back to talk more about that. So that's going to be interesting to keep track of. Also at the table today, Jackie Gingrich Cushman. She is a columnist, syndicated columnist. I read her at JackieCushman.com. And every time I say that, you always say to me, I'm on Town Hall.
Exactly. Well, you can find me anywhere. You can just Google me. I'll pop up.
And also, there it is. This is Jackie's new book, Our Broken America, Why Both Sides Need to Stop Ranting and Stop Listening.
Start listening, yes.
Did I say stop listening?
I think you did.
Yeah, well, thanks for listening. And start listening. It's good to have you back
Thank you.
Us today. And we welcome for the first time to our show Dr. Marilyn Davis. Dr. Davis is a political science professor at Spelman College. You said just before we went on the air, you have been teaching at Spelman. It's hard to believe because you must have been a student teacher since 1981.
Thank you. And I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. We said before the show, we're kind of informal around here. We like to recognize people who have their PhDs, but we kind of call people by their first names, and you said that
Thanks
was okay with you.
Thanks for doing that. I love it.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, let's get started. Jim Galloway, we're all out, and many of us, you, me, our team, Political Rewind team, Greg Bluestein, Tia Mitchell, we're all out there at Tyler Perry Studios Wednesday afternoon getting set for the big debate. We've been watching the impeachment hearings take place in Washington, preparing for the debate, and we're thinking it's impossible there could be a bigger story that could come along to blow either of these out of the water. And at about, I'm thinking 4 o'clock or so, your colleague, Greg Bluestein, broke an even bigger story.
Yeah. This was, of course, in September, Governor Brian Kemp had set up a system of, come one, come all, apply for Johnny Isaacson's U.S. Senate seat. And some 2 months later, Doug Collins, U.S. Representative Doug Collins of Gainesville, says, you know, even if I'm not his pick, I'm running.
We had 500-plus applicants, according to the governor's office. Doug Collins, of course, one of them, by the way, Jackie Cushman, another one, and we're going to get her take on all this in a couple of minutes. But so people had all this time to apply. The governor finally cut off the application process just a week or so ago. I don't have the exact date.
I think just on Monday, this last Monday.
Oh, my gosh. It feels like it was longer ago than that, but fine. All right.
Welcome to political timeline,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly right. But, so here's what happens. On November 8th, the day that President Trump came to Georgia, most of us speculated that Trump being Trump, he might get up on stage and just blurt out.
We got to say, who's on the plane with him coming in from Atlanta?
Doug Collins was on the plane with him.
And so was Sonny Perdue.
And so were the Perdues, who are both, you know, staunch supporters of the Doug Collins bid for this. So everybody thought, well, maybe Trump is going to really blow things up and say, I want Doug Collins. He didn't. But on Wednesday afternoon, we learned that he has called the governor and said, Doug Collins is the guy for the job, which, according to Bluestein's sources, has infuriated Governor Kemp.
Well, it's put him in an impossible situation. I mean, either he has to if he accedes to Trump, then he appears bullied in something as less than a sovereign governor. And if he challenges Trump, well, then obviously Doug Collins is going to be running, and whoever he picks is going to be immediately on a Republican defensive.
Yeah. So the other thing, and then I'll turn it over to the rest of the panel, is that we also learned earlier this week, Doug Collins announced, if I'm not Kemp's choice, I'm going to take him on, and I may take on his choice in the election, which will be in
That was
November.
His message. That was his big threat.
Well, that sets us up, though, for a very interesting 2020 cycle, if indeed Kemp decides to go with a minority or a woman appointee to try and shore up his own chances in 2022. And following the lead that he has already shown in some of his other appointment choices by selecting judges and the insurance commissioner from the minority community, then we're more like the jungle primary we had when you had 18 candidates for CD6 in 2018.
Congressional District 6. Yeah, that's really interesting. Marilyn Davis, I don't want to put you on the spot in your first appearance on the show, but it struck me that Kemp being kind of caught flat-footed about the president saying, I want it to be Doug Collins, was an entirely avoidable situation for him. On November 8th, I started to say before, when the president was in town, we're now told that in the limousine ride that Brian Kemp made with him to the event, he told him then, Trump said then, I think you should pick Doug Collins. At that moment, it strikes me that the governor may have wanted to say, we better shut down the application process on next Monday and Tuesday make our choice. He could have been in charge of all this. It could have been his process, and Trump would have then had to figure out how to respond to it. Instead, unfortunately, the governor is now caught off guard by the president.
Well, the governor should not really be caught off guard when you think about the legislative skills that a president has. The legislative skills are within the party leadership, of course, but he's always thinking, the president is always thinking about what the states bring to the legislature, especially the Senate, but especially the House as well. So I think that the governor should consider that presidents are looking for partisan loyalties, and this is one great way of doing it
as
well.
Yeah, Doug Collins certainly has been his most fierce defender.
With impeachment looming.
Yes. So you've got to have that. Then the bipartisan strategy of coalition building, it may not be so important to the president at this point, but I'm sure it's always in the back of his mind. So are there Democrats who will support me as well? Even in the democratically dominated House, there are members of the House who would still say no to impeachment, mm-hmm. even some Democrats as well. So I think that when you look at the president's role, whoever the president is, then you're not surprised about those decisions that he makes.
But
he campaigns. I'm sorry.
No, I apologize for cutting you off. Finish your thought.
Well, he campaigns in states for that purpose. I need a majority for my continuing policy initiatives.
Okay. So, Jackie, we recognize, and you and I talked about this, mm-hmm. that you have some constraints on what you want to say and all this because you did put your hat in the ring. But I suspect that one of the reasons that this was of interest to you was because you are a woman. You do bring a different face to a Republican mm-hmm. Party dominated by white men. And I, knowing you, imagine that you thought it would be good for this, for your party, to have more a more diverse candidate for this job. So tell us how all this plays out for you right now. We still don't know who Kemp's going to pick. You may very well be his pick.
Let's just back up a little bit. Now, and you're right. That's part of why I'm going to talk about why I put my name in. But let's back up and look at Governor Kemp. So he came in a year ago, and I remember sitting here right before he was elected or as he was elected, and there was a lot of concern about what kind of governor would he be. Mm. And I said, he'll be a very good governor. People were worried about Governor Deal before he became governor, and he's turned out to be great. And Governor Kemp, if you look at his approval ratings, they were 37% when he took office. I think in the 6 months ago, they were 46. They're now at 54, I think. So so he's grown up dramatically in terms of approval rating. So he's in a very good position from his personal stance. We all know he has the right, the obligation, the responsibility to appoint the senator. And I know he takes that very seriously about what's the best for Georgia. The reason that I put my name in the ring, partly to your point, because we do need more, I think, different look for the Republican Party. And we're getting that through these applications, which is really interesting. We have some really interesting applicants that have applied for this job.
Now, I've said on the show several times that the pool of applicants is more diverse than the existing Republican Party in Georgia.
Which is really interesting. And the other reason that I really put my hat in the ring is because I wrote the book. I think if I had not written that book that I would not have put my hat in the ring. But we are so divisive right now, and I clearly have specific policy stances that we'll talk about later. But I do believe we can do it in a way that is civil and that is more interesting and that is more warming and welcoming than we're currently doing now. Now, that's obviously very opposite of Doug Collins, who's pretty much he's a bulldog. So I think, you know, Governor Kemp, he's got a really tough decision. He's made really great decisions in terms of the courts. And I know that he's thinking about this long and hard. I feel very confident he'll make a very good decision. And I do want to point out, I know you wrote about Kelly, or you or Bluestein wrote about Kelly Loeffler, who's up for as well. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out a couple of things that I think are really interesting. Because she's, you know, yes, she's a very successful businesswoman, but she also has a CFA, which is a Chartered Financial Analyst designation, which I also hold. It's very hard to achieve. Only 17% actually get through it. Only 16% of CFA charter holders are women. And she and I have both been in the finance area as an executive. Only 15% of executives are women in the finance area. So I just want to say we have a lot of really qualified people, and I think that's really good for the Republican Party.
Man, Jackie Cushman is hoping that a governor is listening now. I know.
I mean, I think it's great we have highly qualified candidates. It's great to have that problem.
It is interesting, Melita, and then you say what you want to do. But as Jackie talks about wanting to broaden the diversity of the party, we hear many times on this show that Republicans don't have a Melita Easters who knows how to go out and attract women to run for office. And they're pretty envious of what you've been able to do over the years.
Well, thank you. We've moved the needle for Democratic women. But I will say about Kelly Loeffler, long before we knew that Johnny Isaacson would retire, I heard her speak at a 4-H gala for Georgia 4-H clubs when she had made a six-figure gift to the restoration of the chapel at Rock Eagle. And I will tell you, listening to her tell her story of growing up on a farm in the Midwest, she had a very nice presentation, a great connection with that crowd in the way she presented herself. I was inspired enough to go look at her voting record and see who she'd given money to. In the possibility that she would make a good Democratic recruit. But the thing that the governor and everyone on the Republican side of the aisle needs to remember is that women don't vote for women just because they're women. All you'd have to do is look at the CD6 race between Lucy McBath and Karen Handel, which we might very well have in front of us again. And so, yes, she is a successful businesswoman. You are a successful businesswoman and author. But if the values of the candidate are not aligned with the values of the suburban women they are trying to get the votes from, they're not going to do it.
Yeah. What we've got here in this Senate situation, we've got at the 30,000 foot level, we've got a confluence of two different streams. We've got Brian Kemp, who is looking at Virginia and Louisiana and Kentucky and seeing the results there and seeing the suburban revolts there and thinking about how can he protect his party, how can he protect his people and his constitutional officers and maintain Republican control of the Senate's the two U.S. Senate seats. OK, so that you've got that stream. Then on the other one, you've got the impeachment stream. And Doug Collins has made his defense of President Trump is central to his bid. Now he is pitching himself as a guaranteed vote to preserve Trump's presidency when this comes to trial, as it probably will now in the U.S. Senate. And that requires a fellow who is very, very strong with the GOP base. I mean, this isn't about saying nice things about Trump but keeping your distance. This is wrapping your arms around him. So you've got two different needs at two different GOP power centers.
I want to point out that on Wednesday morning I did an interview with David Perdue. Mm-hmm. That's now posted on the GPB News website. You can go listen to it there if you want to. And I asked Perdue, Jackie, whether he thought that this is right before the president weighed in on Doug Collins. I said, do you think that having a candidate who reflects the diversity of Georgia, an African-American candidate, a female candidate, would be a smart thing for the governor to pick? And he said, yeah. He said, this is going to be my running mate, essentially, in 2020. And it would be great. He said, I'm not going to obviously try to tell the governor what to do, but I do think it would be a good thing to do that. And then I said, well, Doug Collins has just announced that he may run for the seat if he's not the choice. Would you tell him not to? And Perdue was very circumspect. He said, I would never presume to tell them what to do, at least publicly.
I think it does create more, a more challenging area. But, you know, this is part of the process, right? I mean, we're a free country. We can speak up and say what we want. We can say we're going to jump in the race if we want to. I think that the Governor Perdue is looking not only at, you know, his race and David Perdue's, but also President Trump's. And quite frankly, all the state legislators. I mean, he's got a House and a Senate here in Georgia that he really wants to protect, and he has to think of it's not even calculus anymore. It's above algebra and calculus. I'm not sure what the math is, but there are a lot of things to consider.
The state house contest that mm-hmm. Melita is focusing so right. heavily on could be decided in the 6th and 7th districts.
Well, and if you have Doug Collins elevated to the Senate, then who knows how many state reps and state senators will give up their seats to run for the Collins congressional seat, which then creates a great deal of fruit basket turnover on the next level. And that is, yes, the northeast corner of Georgia, his congressional seat, but it dips down into Athens. And it includes a lot of previously unengaged minority voters who never even bothered to register or bothered to vote because they didn't think their voice was heard.
So
what happens in that district if the local state senator decides to run for Congress, and then you have several open Senate and House seats and newly engaged voters?
Interesting dominoes. Yes. Marilyn, we've focused on the fact that it would be helpful for the Republican Party to have a woman in the mix. The reason that Kelly Loeffler's name came up on this show a few minutes ago is that there's been a lot of speculation that Kemp may have had her in the back of his mind for quite some time. That may be true. I know that it's been reported, but to the best of my knowledge, it's still somewhat speculative. Nevertheless, we haven't focused on the fact there are some African-American candidates in this race. Robin Crittenden, acting Secretary of State for a period of time, now in another very high-profile job for the state of Georgia, generally very, very well respected. It is an opportunity, regardless of whether Doug Collins is the president's pick or not, for Kemp to do with this job what he's done already in some of his appointments, that's show the diversity of the state and pick an African-American. Yes.
I like the value of diversity, and in addition to that, on an equal basis, the value of civility. And I would love to see in all of the campaigns more people being nice to each other. Even in terms of the debate on Wednesday night, we know that young people are listening. They're very impressionable. They want to be leaders as well. So we should not talk to each other in an uncivil manner. The second has to do with money. So if you have this untapped voting strength, then are those people also going to be turned off by knowing these campaigns require so much money? So I'm not necessarily saying public funding should be used, but just less funding and have more concern about the issues and about people being fair and honest with each other.
All right. So before we end this conversation entirely and move on to one of the other subjects we have to address, Jim, I would go back to what I said a few minutes ago. When Governor Kemp's office announced this way of picking a nominee to say, I'm going to open applications up, it seemed like a really interesting idea. Somewhat, you know, sort of democratizing the process, at least in appearance. But the way things have unfolded, this is sort of backfiring, especially now that Trump has weighed in. It really does put the governor in an impossible situation.
I think he, if in hindsight, I'm sure he would probably tell you if it wasn't in front of a microphone, that I should have given it a specific, say, 3-week life or a 2-week life, then closed it off and made a decision very quickly, because what he's allowed is other people to step in and do it. And I would also say that there's a little undercurrent that we haven't talked about here, that this is in a way, this is kind of an extension of the 2018 GOP runoff for governor. Because you have, of course, Doug Collins is in Gainesville. He lives based in Hall County, as was Governor Deal, as was Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle. They kind of all share a lot of the same political support team. Kemp is outside that circle, of course.
He's an Athens man.
He is an Athens man, and you know, if he were to pick Kelly Loeffler, you know, maybe a first time candidate might choose his political team. So there's some ground game rivalry here, and one kind of imagines maybe Casey Cagle somewhere in the background, chuckling that some of his people have made some trouble for Kemp's first big political decision.
All right. Finally, on this, Jackie Cushman, if in fact Doug Collins isn't the only one. There have been a couple of other Republicans who have said, "Well, maybe I'll jump in too." How do you feel as a Republican? Let's determine one thing. If Governor Kemp doesn't choose you, would you run for the seat?
I think anyone that says they're going to run against an appointed candidate would have to think really long. I mean, I would not recommend anyone do that.
Okay,
quite
so
frankly.
You're not going to do it.
It would not be but people don't often listen to my advice, but that would not be my advice to anybody. It's hard to say, that the governor appointed somebody, but I think I'm going to run anyway.
I think you're right. Now, the only way I think it would make sense to do it is if you have the imprint of Donald Trump.
Well, I mean, certainly that can be done, and
that's right.
But I wouldn't advise it. Again, I think this is
Wait, are you saying let's say Kemp doesn't pick Doug Collins? Are you saying, because I want to make sure you heard what you said? You would advise Doug Collins he should not get in the way.
Absolutely. I would not.
Interesting.
That's my advice. But again, I've advised many candidates, and they don't always take it, as y'all know. But again, I think if you look at what Governor Kemp has to do, he's got to both, you know, think about his state and his party and President Trump. And there is no, the reality is there is no perfect applicant. There are a lot of good things about different people that have applied. And so what he has to do is look at all of them and figure out who's the best fit at this particular time.
All right. But he also may just want to stick it to Trump and Collins for trying to tell him what to do.
All right. That sounds like the advice a Democrat would give a Republican administration. Let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way, and we'll be right back with more on Political Rewind.
That car of yours you no longer need, give it a second life by donating it. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to support this station. Pickup is free. Here's how to get started.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Support for GPB comes from you, our listeners. And Callaway Resort and Gardens, celebrating the season with fantasy and lights, the South's Christmas tradition. Over 5 miles of holiday lights illuminate the forest from November 15th through January 4th. Tickets at CallawayGardens.com. And Georgia Public Library Service, a unit of the University System of Georgia. Kids build confidence and reading skills with eRead Kids, offering pre-K to 4th grade e-books and audiobooks. More at GeorgiaLibraries.org/eReadKid.
We're glad to have you all back with us for Political Rewind, whether you are listening on the radio live on Friday, watching us on Facebook live on Friday, or if you're part of our Sunday morning TV audience, thanks for being with us today. I want a very quick note about our schedule coming up. We're going to be here and do a live show next Monday of Thanksgiving week, and on Tuesday, we're going to do a really interesting show with the author of a new book on the first years of the American Revolution. You don't want to miss that. It's a wonderful conversation. And then Tom Faust and Sam and our entire team are going to take Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday off to be with our friends and family. So we're going to have special programming in place, and we'll be back with you again a week from Monday. I just wanted to make that clear as we go forward. All right, let's talk about the debate. We're not going to be able to drill down too much on all that happened, but let's start with what I thought was an interesting point, Jim. This debate wasn't really terribly interesting in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm not sure that...
And it might have been the fact that, you know, that it was kind of a peak day in the impeachment inquiry. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a blockbuster day of news. And of course, we've already talked about the Kemp Collins thing, but no, I think you're right. I will tell you, and I'd like to hear what Marilyn and Jackie and Melita have on this. But it kind of had the appearance of 10 individual press conferences, and you know, and not a lot of, you know, there wasn't a lot of back and forth. Trump was a very big target for everyone. I was kind of surprised that there wasn't a specific Atlanta flavor I know you're going to say it did pop up, but it took a long time for it to. It was a 2-hour debate, and I think it was toward the close of the debate before we got to issues like voter that are on Stacey Abrams's list, voter suppression and such.
Marilyn, do you think a lot of people learned enough about candidates and firmed up their feelings, switched feelings? What did anything happen in that debate to change much in the way of the dynamic?
Before I answer that question, I'm thinking about what voters and what citizens who involve themselves in surveys say. The candidates don't ask me what I think about anything. Mm. So often there is a kind of taking yourself out of that situation, or maybe hoping that there will be a candidate, or maybe two or three or four, who will express issues that you have an appeal for. I think maybe also the candidates, because it's a pretty large number, they're feeling kind of tired at this time. So what do we talk about? And I think there is that advice from former President Barack Obama. We can't become too extreme. So we need to talk about issues that will be reasonable within that strategy of convergence.
I think that's, Melita, I think that's an interesting point to pick up on. I mean, it was just last Friday that President Obama said, watch out, folks. Let's not go too far down the road in terms of our liberal talking points. And it did feel like this debate, unlike the four before it, was not dominated by Medicare for All, for instance, the Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders plans, and did in fact allow other issues to come to the fore.
That's precisely the point I'd like to make is, number one, this is the only debate so far this season where the combination of commentators and candidates, women dominated.
Mm-hmm.
Women were the majority on that stage.
Somebody pointed out that's right. There were more women on the stage than men for the first time in a presidential debate ever.
The other thing is, you heard about some of what we call the kitchen table issues, mm-hmm. like child care. And so there were issues that had not been discussed in previous debates. Abortion came up. So you had a different flavor, in part because it was female-dominated. And it came on a day or during a week when women had also dominated some of the testimony about the impeachment. So that was, I think, to see that much woman power dominating the headlines made it a more interesting week for me and the people
what
I
was
talked
a,
to.
What was it like to either watch or then read about it? I didn't ask you whether you got to see the whole debate, Jackie. What was the Republican point of view watching that debate unfold?
So I actually watched the whole debate, which I think because it was pretty boring is amazing. I was very proud of myself. Past my bedtime. So I did watch the whole debate. I do think that my favorite part, there were a lot of talking points. A lot of people trying to get across things that they had memorized from their consultants. But my favorite part was when Tulsi and Gabbard went head-to-head, and you could see her. She was so, back to your point earlier, I think we're talking about being civil. She was so calm and so controlled, but so clearly articulated her position that regardless of whether or not you agreed with her, you could appreciate how passionate and what her perspective was. But she did it so, I thought, so nicely.
I thought Kamala Harris had one of her best moments of the night, though, in responding by saying to Gabbard, you spent the entire Obama administration on Fox News criticizing him. Are you a Democrat or not? But
well, that's
you know,
a very
be that as it may. So let's talk about one thing very specific.
Yes.
It was interesting that Pete Buttigieg, despite the fact that he's now moved up to first place in Iowa, and at least one poll, St. Anselm's College in New Hampshire, has him first there as well, didn't take the fire that an Elizabeth Warren has taken in past debates. He really got he didn't get much of an attack launched on him. And I'm wondering, I don't know why, but he and Kamala Harris did have some back and forth on an issue that matters very much to you, which is how African-American women deal with being part of the electoral process. Kamala Harris's campaign had criticized him as part of his African-American outreach. His campaign had posted a photograph of what they thought was an American black person, and it turned out to be a Kenyan. That looked bad. There were a couple of missteps with African-Americans. So I'm curious, when you think about this whole notion of where Pete Buttigieg stands with black voters.
I think it is on the fence, and I'm not sure whether it will be falling off or maybe surviving. Black voters see themselves as very good public judges. And by that I mean, here's a candidate, here's another candidate. I know something about that person's stance. How does that stance fit with my interest? And if you don't get that quickly and if you don't get it solidly, then people come away very lukewarm about that.
Yeah. Marilyn, let me ask you. Okay, you're over at Spelman. You're teaching, what, four or five courses? You've got a heavy load. Okay, right. No. Just what's your impression? Which candidates do you suspect that your students are lining up behind right now? Where are young black voters going?
It's really hard to say. It depends on the class. It depends on the time of the month, the week. I would say mostly it is Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And that also fits with this public judgment. So I know Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. I know about him in the Obama administration. He was the running mate, Vice President of the United States. I know some other things about him earlier, but I'm not so concerned about what he did in the 90s and the statements he made. But I feel that he is the solid candidate that I would consider. In terms of women candidates, so far,
Kamala Harris doesn't have much of a following on campus?
Not much. She has some following, but not a lot of it.
I think it's really interesting, Melita, that there are two African-American candidates on that stage, and I think they have different problems. But Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, articulate, have great energy, and they just haven't caught on. Now, I would argue that the different problems are that Kamala Harris has had a hard time focusing. What is her message exactly? Who is she really? Why is she running for president? Where with Cory Booker, it's been more a matter of the kumbaya messaging that he started the campaign with just hasn't resonated. And it's a different kind of problem.
But they both got some good lines in. And Cory Booker's tribute to John Lewis was very lovely.
It was very elegant. And eloquent.
And I think Kamala Harris perhaps deals with the fact that sometimes when African-American women who have been prosecutors run for a different kind of office, they have trouble connecting.
What Marilyn is saying is kind of resonating. Just the established record, the steady record. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that maybe your average black Democrat isn't much different from your average white Democrat, in which the priority is going to be on ousting Mr. Trump in November. So, and that becomes a bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Jackie, yesterday morning I went over to watch Al Sharpton at his breakfast, mm-hmm. at his National Action Network breakfast, where he had like five of the candidates show up. Obviously, all the candidates came to town hoping to court black voters, and they were in all the right places to court black voters. Al Sharpton did his event at Paschal's, which they call the historic Paschal's. I said on the show the other day, no, it's not.
It
was on MLK. The new Paschal's is very lovely, but it is not the same. So Buttigieg was there. And Sharpton introduced him in a very lovely way, really, mm-hmm. talking about how the similarities that Buttigieg, as a gay man, the discrimination that he faced, his commitment to civil rights, which he could certainly apply to understanding the problems of discrimination that African Americans have. And Buttigieg picked up on that theme. But I think there are an awful lot of African Americans who would push back very strongly if you say, oh, our problems as African Americans are just like the problems that gay and lesbians have.
I'm going to let Melina.
All right.
Doctor answer this. I would think so, but I think she's a much better spokeswoman for this.
Without saying too much as well, because this was a research presentation in my national government class, so.
You can take those off if you want.
Okay, thank you. So there was a research paper on diversity rights. And there were also research paper questions in that presentation on pro-choice and pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
So the presenter, the student, was excellent. She said, well, this question I have, she had 10 questions, tell me where you stand and you go to this part of the room or that part of the room. As far as the pro-choice and pro-life questions, students readily went in what we would think is the direction expected. But then when it came to the questions of diversity and difference, there were students who were going, but no, I'm really not feeling that way. So I got the immediate impression that that one issue is a bone of contention. There are many black voters who are not quite ready for that.
So, and we're talking LGBT acceptance.
Exactly.
Well, the other thing is that the Buttigieg really has a fairly privileged background. Mm. And that means that as a gay man, he had a greater acceptance within his circle than a young gay black man in a housing project in Atlanta might have.
All right. So he was interesting. Cory Booker, I've got to say, I followed Cory Booker to two events, Jim. He is the most exuberant candidate I have seen on the campaign trail in a genuine way.
And this is the puzzle because despite that exuberance, he's not catching on.
Yeah.
I mean, he had some of the best emotional moments in the debate. He had this wonderful line. The next day I can't remember where it was. You could probably tell me better, where he says, if we're going to be at the table, we have to be at the table.
Yeah.
You know, we have to
at Reverend Al's.
So. Yeah.
But I think
this
rolls back into, I think you made the point earlier that even though you have a specific profile, you don't necessarily connect, right, with voters.
I mean, well, his line about, I'm the other Rhodes Scholar mayor on the stage.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, he has an amazing story, but you're right. He hasn't connected.
Not connecting.
He might be the perfect vice president, depending upon who is at the top of the ticket, and that might be why he's staying in the race.
By the way, we'll go back to Mayor Pete for just a second, Jackie. Quinnipiac just put out a new poll just the other day, and among African-American voters, he literally is at zero.
I think he's going to have a hard time once the primaries come down south. Yes. It's going to be very difficult for him.
Yeah. Tom points out, I should add, and that's a South Carolina poll. It's not a national
poll.
Right. But that's the next step.
That was my point. It's going to be hard when he comes down south.
You know, he goes through Iowa, New Hampshire, and then he hits
how that works.
That's right. Newt Gingrich, your father, went through a very similar problem and understands it well.
Well, opposite problem. He actually did really well in Georgia,
and
obviously,
then,
in South Carolina. He won the southern states, right.
Let's take another break, come back. We got a lot more to talk about on Political Rewind.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, how much do you really know about Marie Curie? A new play tackles her loves, her sorrows, and her greatest joys.
We love our lovers, we adore our children, but our life's passion is proof.
Madame Curie on stage on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Join us for Science Friday this afternoon at 3, right here on GPB.
I'm Christy Kent, the Director of Communications for the George's Rome Office of Tourism. Our mission is to strengthen the economic prosperity of the community through tourism development. We underwrite with GPB because they create strong connections with our listeners through storytelling that is full of rich and meaningful content.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
This show is very much a democracy. Jim Galloway during the break said, where are we going next? I made one suggestion. Jackie Cushman said, why don't we talk about Karen Handel? I said, okay. There is some developing news around the 6th District Congressional race and the attempt that Republicans are making to unseat Lucy McBath up there. And what seems to be happening is the race for the Republican nomination has consolidated dramatically.
Well, absolutely. And let's back up, because it is Congresswoman McBath's district currently. She serves the district, the 6th District of Georgia, which my dad held previously. Even though it wasn't the original 6, we can go to that later. But, you know, it's interesting because it's finally consolidating. I mean, you know, Karen is a really hard worker.
We should say Brandon Beach,
Thank
who
you.
Potentially could have been a very powerful candidate in that race. He was raising almost as much money as Handel was. he kind of quickly, and to Met's surprise, decided not to do it. He dropped out.
He is, and now she's added support. She has Senator Isaacson, Senator Perdue, Governor Kemp. She has my father endorsed her actually much earlier on, and she's held that seat before, so that I think is very helpful. The NRCC is treating her like an incumbent. It's that she's one of the top contenders. They're helping her a lot. She's doing well in fundraising. Her main challenge, quite frankly, is because she can run very well on the record, is that Congresswoman McBath won in part, or who knows, you know, how much, but Mayor Bloomberg poured in $5 million in the last month of the campaign for the last election against Karen Handel, and that made a huge difference. So the question is, how much money is he going to pour into the Georgia 6th District, and how much difference does money make?
Well, especially if he's running for president and wants to spend the money on his own campaign.
I'm not sure there is a limit to that money, though. Who knows?
Well, that's right.
But I think Lucy McBath has a powerful message. The Congresswoman has grown dramatically in her range of issues she's comfortable talking about and in her knowledge base. And she's established a strong team around herself. I believe that Karen Handel will have a formidable task if she believes she can truly win this race.
I think, Jim, I am not yet convinced. I understand that the Republican conference has endorsed her in Washington, but they're not, you know, just last week or so, I think a week or so ago, the Republicans produced a new commercial that was an attack ad on Democrats in general, the Nancy Pelosi crowd, whatever. And they bought TV time in many congressional districts, and they just had digital ads running in others where they could put in a Lucy McBath.
Right.
And they only bought the digital ads in Georgia. And that makes me wonder a little.
Okay, well, here, I think what this is, what you do, if you watch politics enough, as we all do here, you look at the actions, and the actions are kind of an admission. You have Brandon Beach bowing out of the race. I cannot. Please help me with the other name.
Yeah.
Nicole
Rodden.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
She bowed out too. So we only have, so far as I know, we have Marjorie Taylor Greene is the only candidate. She's a very, very hardcore Second Amendment candidate in the race against Handel. So what you have is a consolidation of the Republicans in the six are doing what Democrats have had to do in the past, and that is narrow the field to make it more likely to increase their chances of success. And that tells me that they're really worried about the numbers. The timing of this is actually interesting. This Brandon Beach's withdrawal came maybe what 10 days, 2 weeks after the municipal elections that saw the election of a Democratic mayor in Dunwoody and in a number of North Fulton.
Yeah, I think Maryland.
Well, and you have a lot of really closely decided legislative seats last time within the 6th congressional district. And so the Republicans are hoping to take back a few of the flips and preserve all the seats they still hold in that district. And what you see is when you have a nested group of candidates within the same geographic territory, you have a House seat, a Senate seat, and a congressional seat, and you have all these grassroots activists on the ground, as we do for the Democratic women candidates, the voter participation on the Democratic side of the aisle increases.
All right. We're going to watch that race. It's going to be fascinating. I think you're right. Karen Handel now is in a position of strength. Is it enough? We'll see how it unfolds. Meryl, just for a couple minutes, let's talk about an interesting ruling that we saw out of a federal judge in Florida this past week. The Democratic Party of Florida went in to court to argue that the placement of a name on the ballot, which in Florida is done, if your party won the governor's office in the most recent election, all of the candidates running in the various offices in Florida of your party are first on the ballot. The Democrat, by the way, Georgia has the same rule. The judge looked at the information that was presented at trial and saw that there was data that shows being first on the ballot, having your name first, is as much as a 5-point advantage. Now, we should point out, by the way, that in Georgia, it was Governor Roy Barnes, the Democrat, who passed that statute. So yes, it goes both ways.
It does.
But it's fascinating that there is that much impact of having your name first on the ballot. And if this thing goes up in appeal process, which it will, we don't know when it'll play out. But if it stands, Georgia's going to have to reconfigure its ballot or rethink how it does its balloting.
It will. And that will also mean a different strategy. Maybe the strategy has to be more emboldened and more empowering for the party that wants to win these elections. Could I add to that a president's concern about the Senate, the composition of the Senate, with Supreme Court positions may be up for grabs?
Yeah. Yeah.
We're already in 2019. Yeah. What will 2021 hold? So you need to have that solid Senate. This is a concern that any president would have. I need another nomination. I need another confirmation.
Jackie, if this rule stands, if it's challenged and therefore isn't resolved in time for necessarily the 2020 election, it means that here in Georgia, Donald Trump will be the first name that voters will see when they go into the ballot box, which could be an enormous advantage or trouble.
I would guess, and I don't know the research, but my guess is this is true more for the nonpartisan lower-end races. We don't know all the candidates versus the presidential races when at least most of the voters would know the candidates. Or in my dad's case, when you're Newt Gingrich and your name is so odd that people can remember the name. But for instance, I met with Lindsey Rutter, who's running for the Georgia Court of Appeals, nonpartisan race, right, in the spring. So you're worried about turnout. And for someone that has an R in the last name, it is something to consider.
Yeah, it's interesting. If they overturn this Florida law, okay, that's fine. But by what standard do you use to list people on the ballot? If it's alphabetical, are we being injudicious to the Zabrinskis of the world?
Yes.
Exactly.
Always.
Rotate.
You get a quick last word.
In rotation. Yes.
You could make it random. And it appears on the ballot in different places at different times.
With or without the party, right? Who knows?
I'm gonna pause the political conversation because we're almost out of time for today's show. And I'll thank the panel in a minute. But I did want to take just a minute or so to pay tribute to somebody who is today celebrating, or this week, an extraordinary anniversary in broadcasting. Our good friend Ernie Johnson has been at TNT for 30 years this week.
Wow.
I want to tell a quick story. Ernie Johnson was part of the weekend anchor team at Channel 2 News when a woman named Kimberly Kennedy, David Chandley, our weather guy, and I were the other anchors. Ernie was our sports anchor. And one day Ernie came into the studio looking a little downtrodden. We said, "What's the matter, Ernie?" He said, "This is the end of my... I'm not going to be here any longer." So why? The general manager at the time was looking at his contract and had him in his office. And he said, "Ernie, you can be weekend sports anchor here for the rest of your career. But I want you to know, if you sign a contract today, I don't see you being a material to be the principal sports anchor. That's just not you. You're not good enough." And Ernie left Channel 2 to many tears because we loved him dearly, and it's done pretty well for himself.
And if you stack his career on that of his dad, I mean, that's at least 50 years of Atlanta broadcast.
Ernie Sr. and Ernie Jr. are two of the finest, have been two of the finest people you could want to know in our business, and I just wanted to take a minute to congratulate him on all that he's accomplished and on what he's done with his personal life. He's led a difficult but exemplary personal life as well. So thank you all on the panel for giving me a chance to do a shout out for Ernie, 30 years at TNT. We're out of time for today's show. Marilyn Davis, thank you so much for being here today
for your first appearance. It's wonderful.
Jackie Cushman, we always love having you. The book, Our Broken America, And we sell that for you whenever we can.
Thank you.
Melita Easter, thank you. We'll see you soon, I hope. Jim Galloway, great to have you here. You'll be with me again Monday for our final live show before the Thanksgiving holiday. And thank you all for being here. See you Monday at 2:00.